8:18 now. Good morning. Well, as we just reported, the Summit County Council had got an earful from residents about the proposed tax increase by the Snyderville Basin Recreation District. On the phone to talk about that and other budget issues, I have Council Member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Leslie.
So, got the proposed tax increase got a lot of attention from residents wondering why they have to pay for a trail system that's getting a lot of use from outsiders. Can we figure out some fee system or tax system to charge non-county visitors?
Yes, I think we can. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's a more recent phenomenon. I mean, it's grown every year, but it's now, as some commentators said, it's, like 50-50 proposition. I don't know if that's the right number, but there certainly are a lot of people enjoying what we built that have no connection to it financially. And but it's like, as Brian Hatton said, we have 15 trailheads and 170 miles of trail, and there's a lot of places that you can access it. And, if we have an army of enforcement people, which, these are not, it's not the kind of thing you can just deputize a volunteer. Our experience has been, especially when there's, a dog off leash or animal control issues, that we have to call the sheriff. Our animal control people are not respected. They don't carry the same gravitas that a deputy sheriff does. And it's got to be thought well through. But, yes, we need to do something about it.
Yeah, so if Basin Rec starts doing that, then does Park City start charging people to get onto the Round Valley, Bonanza Flat, Treasure Hill trails? I mean, city taxpayers are paying big bucks for all of that open space.
Well, I think we need to have coordinated policies. The kind of concepts that we might see is that locals get a free pass for parking or some decal on their bike or some certificate or license they can carry, and that others would have to buy a short-term or annual pass some fashion and then would have to police it. And I don't think that's, I was trying to do the math. People were saying last night, well, if everybody paid $10, I don't know how many, if you have 10,000 people, 20,000, there's $200,000 a year in revenue, that might pay for the enforcement. If there's 200,000, then it's different. I don't know how many there are. We don't know. And, but certainly we need parks. People don't distinguish between trails managed by Park City's Recreation Department and Basin Recreation. They don't, frankly, I don't often know when the boundary switches.
In retrospect, should the district have asked for a series of incremental tax hikes rather than one big tax increase after 15 years?
This is not the first time we've had these things, the county increased our general tax after 30 years or something of not doing it. We're loath to increase them, and then it builds up, and it's kind of, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If we went through truth in taxation every year at 2%, the base direct did, like I said at last night's meeting, that people would say, well, you always got your hand out. And then when they try to forbear and there's no adjustments for inflation, so 15 years of erosion in the purchasing power of, then they try to make that up, and it's, like I say, you're damned if you do and don't, but it would probably still be wise in hindsight to incrementally increase, maybe not every year, but to try to get on, just almost put it on the calendar.
So it sounds like the council will follow up with Kim Carson's idea, kind of get a subgroup of council members to meet with the rec district, try to revise the budget?
Yeah, in the next 7 days.
Yeah. Mountain Regional surplus water rate. Just explain a bit more why you held this special meeting on Tuesday and came up with the $5 per 1,000 gallons rate, a discount from the $6.40 per 1,000 gallons that was originally proposed.
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to, and I said this in this meeting we had prior to yesterday's meeting, retreat back into the dark ages where, you know, for a long time, the water wars, as I call them, existed, where Summit Water and Park City Municipal and Mountain Regional were at each other's throats and protesting everything.
Chris,
we've resolved that. We're working well together. And Summit Water would argue that there's a flaw in our regionalization agreement because when they say, give a 5-year projection of that they need like this 700 acre feet of water over the next 5 years, they're not told what it's going to cost them. And so they have to commit it's take or pay. So a few years ago, they said, yeah, we need 700 acre feet. And the rate was then $4.08 a gal, a thousand. And then, you know, all of a sudden in late 2019, you know, the rate $6.40. What if next year is $10? You know, and so out of sympathy for the fact that there are a lot of assumptions in determining the cost, because, you know, you've got to make judgments as to allocations. It's not like you just look in a textbook and says, oh, yeah, here's what it is. And out of recognition that they have a lot of challenges, that would be a huge increase. And those sorts of things, phasing it in, I don't think that, you know, I personally don't think that that hurts things. It's and then there's the flip side of it. If you know, it is surplus water. What would Mountain Regional do if Summit Water didn't need any of it? Then where would that revenue come from? Would we have a tax increase or a rate increase for the Mountain Regional customers? So there's just a lot of sides to it. I think phasing it in. I also thought Scott Morrison's suggestion that they have a third-party independent study conducted next year that would put a value, you know, an arm's-length value on what that surplus water rate should be. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. So Mountain Regional The Mountain Regional Board came up with that $6.40 per thousand gallons based on data. So I'm guessing if we don't know.
No, I've been over the data. It's got a lot of assumptions in it, and it's a big jump. You know, it would have been, 70% jump or something in 1 year. And then, of course, the other factor that has been disclosed by Summit Water is that they projected growth faster than it has occurred, and so they're paying for water that they're not using. And so you could argue that's a windfall to Mountain Regional, you know, that they're committed to take 700 acre feet. They're only going to take 400, but they're paying for 7. So the board, it's really the board's decision, and they're going to have to meet. They'll unfortunately meet after our meeting on the 11th, they meet on the 12th. But anyway, I think it'll work its way out. And I think it's can be viewed as a win-win for the community and not a win-lose.
All right. On other topics, regarding the hearing on the general budget, the only comment coming from Tom Farkas was Save People, Save Wildlife, again asking for $1.9 million to extend the wildlife fencing along the highways to prevent animal and car collisions. So what's the reaction from the council? It looks like you are proposing that Save People work with the county staff to find some funding from state and federal sources.
Yes. I mean, Save Wildlife, Save People. It's that, you know, there's millions of dollars. It costs millions of dollars every time there's a wildlife collision, or, you know, not every time, but the cumulative cost, and that it would only take $1 million, whatever, to fill these gaps. And of course, one of the problem is there's a disconnect between who incurs the costs and who, you know, do the collisions and who pays to fill the gaps. And, you know, it's not like Summit County is spending $5 million a year that it could avoid spending if it spent $1 million filling the gaps. It's, there are costs experienced by those that you know, whose vehicles hit the wildlife and medical costs and things. And so it's not simple math, but if there are grants out there and if state and federal agencies and nonprofits and others can help, we should certainly pursue those and fill these gaps. That'd be great.
Finally, I just wanted to note that you've been named as chairman of the Central Wasatch Commission. Did you happen to see the recent news that four ski resorts there in the Cottonwood Canyons backing off the land swap proposals? And what was your reaction to that?
Well, of course I saw it. I that's late news. That was a month and a half ago almost. No, 5 weeks ago. Yes. The land exchanges in the legislation for the Central Wasatch National Conservation Recreation Area Act are based on value for value, and there's other restrictions that the Forest Service is trying to impose. And the reason that they're backing away is they think there's like a 100-to-1 value ratio. So, for instance, If you have 100 acres of hillside land and you have 1 acre at the base and the acre at the base is worth 100 times and the hillside land's worth $1,500, so, you know, the currency is just so out of whack that it makes making the exchange, you know, undesirable. That, you know, if Snowbird has 2,000 acres and it's worth, say, $300,000, and they give that up and they get 2 acres at the base, whoop-de-doo. You know, I mean, why bother? And that's kind of it's like that currency doesn't stretch very far. It's not economics. And so the question is, how important are the land exchanges how important is it for the resorts to get control of their base? In many cases, it's land that the Forest Service owns on which they have a lease and they already have buildings. And they just want to unify the title. But are there other ways to resolve that? Is there, you know, is exchange the only way? And the broader question is, how important are the exchanges to the resorts and to the viability of the legislation? Those are the issues. But it doesn't surprise me that if the exchange ratios are so out of whack, why would they do them? That doesn't surprise me. I wouldn't do them either.
Yeah. Okay. I need to leave it there. Hey, Chris, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, the state-sponsored Welcoming Schools teacher training program has divided the Park City community. A group of parents have sent a cease and desist order to the Park City School District, putting them on notice that unless this training stops and the books and materials are pulled out of the schools, they'll go forward with a lawsuit. On the phone with me, I have Ellen Kahn. She is the Senior Director of Programs and Partnerships with the Human Rights Council, which has put together this teacher training program. Good morning, Ellen. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, tell us what the mission of the Human Rights Council is.
Well, it is the Human Rights Campaign, to be specific. We are an organization that has been around nearly 40 years, based in Washington, D.C., with operations in many states. We have the division I represent is the HRC Foundation. We are the nonprofit division, and we provide training and education and resources to help all types of institutions and organizations become more inclusive and welcoming of the LGBT community. So that includes schools, child welfare organizations, healthcare organizations, corporations, just looking at all the different approaches to becoming a more kind of inclusive space for the LGBT community, but as well for all folks from all different walks of life.
Yeah.
Welcoming Schools is the program we developed to focus primarily on elementary schools, where given the increasing diversity in schools across the country, both including families headed by LGBTQ parents, as well as students with other LGBTQ family members or their own identities as part of the LGBT community, really helping those early experiences in school become more favorable and more inclusive.
Yeah. So given, though, that your organization can be polarizing, why not just provide the training without attaching your name to it? I think that for many, the campaign's involvement in the training is the reason that they're opposed to it.
Sure. Yes. I think that folks, there's not a lot of information about the real breadth of work that we do at the Human Rights Campaign. A lot of people do know our political work, but we have a lot of programs that are very different in nature, where we're simply helping people understand the experiences of LGBT folks and just what how we are part of all families, part of all communities, and just helping folks have a deeper understanding of what inclusion looks like. So, we also put a lot of effort and resources into this program, Welcoming Schools. And so, there's no reason for us not to sort of say, hey, this is a program we're really proud of and a program that organizations like the National Education Association and National Association of School Psychologists are, very supportive of and partner on. So we're proud of the incredible program we've developed that is, endorsed by many folks who are professional educators.
Yeah. So have you had a similar reaction in other communities where this program is presented?
We have, yeah. We have. We're sort of surprised that in some more conservative places we don't see much backlash at all. And sometimes in places like San Francisco, there'll be some parents who are unhappy with this. So there isn't any. It's not always predictable per se. What we have found, Leslie, is that once parents understand the actual content in Welcoming Schools, they tend to understand that this is not we're not bringing content into schools that is not appropriate for the developmental ages and stages of the children. What we're doing is we are working with adults like you and me who are, who are having interactions with children every day so that they can use language and terminology and use stories and lessons that help to cultivate an understanding of all kinds of diversity. While Welcoming Schools is very intentionally LGBT inclusive, it addresses the full breadth of diversity and it takes on all kinds of bias-based bullying that may be based on someone being gay or perceived as gay, for example, but also just as emphatically addresses behavior that might be biased based on race, religion, physical ability, or any other number of identities that children have.
Yeah, and I think everybody agrees that, we don't want to see any type of bullying happen. I think what's difficult, though, for parents here is that they believe that this training in particular infringes on their rights to teach their children these notions of, the LGBT affiliations themselves. And that's, I think, it's even though there's training involved, it's not the training that the parents would use themselves. So how do we get beyond that?
Yeah, well, again, I feel like there's a real disconnect between what's actually in the Welcoming Schools materials versus what parents may fear is in the materials. And in fact, I just in terms of kind of my keeping an eye on how the Park City community is responding, it looks like a lot of the opinion pieces that are being published and a lot of the parent voices that I'm seeing in your local papers there are kind of skewing toward supporting inclusion and that Welcoming Schools is not something we should fear. And I think that is, again, once people understand what it is. I mean, there, you know, some kids have LGBTQ parents. Some kids are going to be LGBTQ. We have, you know, children who understand their gender identity at young ages and are transgender. And, you know, parents can, you know, share their beliefs at home about how they feel about the fact that LGBTQ folks exist. But when you go to school every day, you know, you have to be, you have to embrace the full diversity of all the students that are in your classroom. And, you know, those schools include people who are part of the community or who have friends and family members who are part of the community. So, you know, you can't sort of put your head in the sand and not, like, just, you know, address the fact that this is part of our diverse community. You're not saying, you know, that you're not taking a position on what religious beliefs are about LGBT folks, or, you know, you're not, this isn't about, you know, quote unquote endorsing, you know, a particular sexual orientation. It's just helping people navigate from a young age. You know, you can't teach children why it's hurtful to call someone gay when you're mad at them or when you don't like them, unless you can say, you know, do you know what the word gay means? And is there another word you can use? Because using that as a slur is hurtful to someone. Like, we have to be able to give children the tools they need. And what I find quite fascinating and eye-opening is that when you talk to kids about even the words lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, the kids know these words. They've heard these words. They don't, they're not really struggling so much with, you know, they don't find it controversial. It's the parents, it's the adults. And so the whole point of welcoming schools is to help the adults who are, you know, spending the days with our kids in school, help them have better skills and tools so that if anti-LGBTQ words are used in the classroom, if someone's teased for any reason, but including because it's a boy who's acting feminine or, you know, that sort of thing, that the teachers are just as equipped to address that in a teachable way, a thoughtful way, as they are to address if a child was being targeted because of their race or their size or any other part of their identity.
Yeah. And I guess why would a school use this training as opposed to the others that are out there?
Well, most of the trainings that are out there do not address at all gender stereotyping, do not address at all LGBTQ bias. They are generally kind of generic, kind of a quote-unquote be nice to everyone. I've seen that in my own kids' schools. It doesn't really get into what do we mean by difference and diversity. What is bias based on? How does it show up? So it kind of does a disservice to children if we're not saying to them, you know, not just say if they use a racial slur, like don't say that, but like this is why we don't say that. This is why that word's so hurtful. And I think children deserve a more robust education around what we call social emotional learning to really learn how their behavior affects other children, to understand in some context why using a certain word or treating someone a certain way is a problem. And so Welcoming Schools is actually one of the only programs that helps teachers and other adults in the school community really build their skills so that they aren't simply saying that's not nice, but they're saying, wait a minute, let's unpack this a little bit. Let's help children actually understand what that word means, or, you know, why that word is particularly offensive, or help them develop a vocabulary for expressing anger or frustration that doesn't require hurting someone's feelings. And so, and Welcoming Schools really focuses on a much more sort of skills-based approach for educators and other adults in the school, yeah. So that what they teach has meaning, that it actually changes the behavior.
And I know it's certainly not your decision, but do you think that the Human Rights Campaign would get involved if, in fact, a lawsuit was filed on over this issue?
You know, Leslie, the Utah State Department of Education made a decision based on what they understand about welcoming schools, what they, as experts, saw as valuable in the program. They invested money and time in being able to provide this professional development. We feel like they are better equipped than anybody to stand by their decision. We don't have any need to be involved in what is a local, issue for a particular school district.
Okay. Ellen, I need to leave it there. I appreciate your time this morning.
Sure. Thanks, Leslie.
Ellen Kahn is the Human Rights Campaign Senior Director of Programs and Partnerships. 8:45 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Egyptian Youth Theater presents A Christmas Carol, a live radio play this weekend. It opens Friday night. Two shows on Saturday and a Sunday matinee. In the studio with details, I have Jamie Wilcox, the artistic and managing director of Youth Theater, along with a couple of the actresses in the play, Avery Dennis and Elena Nurilla. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So we'll start with you, Jamie, and maybe just tell us a little bit about the production.
Great. So this is our first production in our brand new studios, the new home of Youth Theater. So it's our first show in our new Black Box Theater. And it's really been fun and exciting and also slightly stressful, but that's the way that live theater goes because the space is just barely ready. So that's why we chose a radio play. We wanted something to explore the new space that didn't have a lot of singing and dancing and running all over the place. So that's why we chose this radio play, but it's really fun to watch live as well because it's set in the 1940s. So all the characters are 1940s characters playing radio characters. So it's kind of a play within a play, if you will. And all the sound effects are being done live and the audience gets to see all of that happen.
Okay. So I understand what you mean. I didn't get the radio part. So
right.
It was like as if you were listening as opposed to watching it.
We are going to make it into a podcast episode for our happy holidays to all of our Pharaoh members and all of our Youth Theater families. But as the live audience gets to watch it, the all of our students, they're in costume, 1940s costume. So they get to, it fills both of those. You will get to listen to it, but you also get to see how a radio play would be performed live.
Okay. So this is based on the classic?
The classic Ebenezer Scrooge change of heart story. Yes.
Okay. How many in the production do you have?
We have 18 students, two student crew members and two student assistant stage managers.
Okay. It's all youth, huh?
All youth,
cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Avery, what characters are you playing?
I'm playing Mrs. Cratchit, which is Scrooge has a worker, which is Bob Cratchit, and I play his wife.
And who's your son?
My son's Tiny Tim, the classic Tiny Tim.
Sure. Okay, is that your role? Is it a major role then?
Yeah, my role. Yeah.
And you also do a couple other voices.
Yeah. Couple other little things, yeah.
Okay, and then Elena, how about you?
I play Peter Cratchit, Bob Cratchit's son. I also play Kate, Ebenezer Scrooge's nephew's wife. and I work at the sound table and stuff too.
Yeah, so because it's like a radio show, you can see I have lots of scripts. Do you guys get scripts or is it all memorized?
Our lines ourselves are memorized, but we actually, it's really cool, we have commercials, like little old commercials to do. And since when they did commercials for radio plays back then, we have little scripts for that, but we do know our lines for that. So, yeah.
Okay, so this is something different than for both of you, huh?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just kind of performing on the stage. And do you like it? Do you prefer one over the other?
I like it. I think it's cool to try a different way.
Both of them are really fun experiences. I'd say both of them are pretty fun.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So I see that looks like you've been rehearsing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're wearing stage makeup and stuff then, huh? That's part of it.
We have about 250 local schools coming in today, 250 students from local schools being bused in. So we'll have our first audiences this morning at 9:30.
Okay. And again, this is all taking place in the new theater on the west side of Main Street, huh?
Yes, but it's actually accessed from the Egyptian side of the street. There is a tunnel that goes underneath Main Street, and so that you still enter from the same side of the street and go underground. And but when you're down there and you see how big the space is, it's kind of surprising that it's all in a basement. Yeah, so we're very, very excited.
Okay, so tickets are on sale online?
Yes, they sure are. Do you want to tell us where they can get tickets, Avery?
Yeah, so it's $10 for 17 and under.
And $15 for adults.
And where do they get tickets?
Oh, they get it on parkcityshows.com/youththeater.
Or you can call 649-9371.
Okay, well, good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. KPCW News Time now, 8:50. Good morning. Well, a youth-hosted global climate strike is happening tomorrow at the Utah State Capitol from 2 to 4 p.m. with the help of Climate Action Campaign. That's a program of the Utah Sierra Club. The youngsters plan to strike in opposition of state oil and gas lease sales that will auction off public lands, which will further fossil fuel development in the state. In the studio, I have the co-presidents of the Park City High School Climate Action Club, Tess Carson, Emma Cook, and Nina Serafin. Good morning, girls. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So just because we've got three female voices, it's probably going to be a little bit easier if you just kind of introduce yourself before one of you starts talking. Does somebody want to take on just and tell us what is happening tomorrow and why? And you're Emma.
Yes, I'm Emma Cook. So tomorrow we are going to be striking down at the Capitol alongside hundreds of other youth and just anyone, demanding change and demanding climate justice to be taken from our representatives. It'll be at the Utah State Capitol from 2 to 4. This is a movement that was started by Greta Thunberg in Sweden and has been adapted throughout the U.S., and the world, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And at Tess, it looks like you are one of those who are scheduled to speak.
Yes, I am.
How were you selected?
So we were at the meeting planning the strike, and there was an offer up, or whoever wanted to speak, and I just asked if I could.
Okay, so what are you going to be talking about?
So I'm going to be talking about, and through the last year, SUA has been collecting postcards that say, Governor Herbert, please protect our wild lands. It's your last year in office. We need you to like save the lands and not lease them to oil and gas. So we were trying to deliver the letters to him, but we got notice yesterday that he won't be able to take them. So we are just gonna say I wrote a speech and we're just gonna be talking about like, Governor, like it's your last year. Just please take action. Like, yeah.
All right. So do we have anybody else from Park City who will be speaking that you know of?
No.
Okay. And then as I introduced you, you're all co-presidents then of Climate Action Club. So tell me, but how long have you guys been involved in the club? How big is it?
So we started it at the end of October after we went to a Utah Environmental Summit camp. And we learned just a lot about how to get more involved with your school and be able to take climate action in your local town or city. And so we basically made this club so that we can gather all the passionate students at our school together and take action. And it's been going really well. We have about 15 members that come every meeting. We have a meeting twice a month. And yeah, we're right now focusing on education first, which is our main goal, so that we can get everyone on the same page and knowing about all the issues.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there a specific mission of the club?
We really just want to be able to, like, get change within our town first. So right now we're working on 100% renewable energy plan at Park City High School. And we're working with Sierra on that as well. But, yeah.
Okay. And what would that renewable energy plan look like, putting solar panels on the
schools? Yeah, so Park City High School has solar panels, and we're really just trying to use them. Also, we're using styrofoam currently in our lunches still, which is very bad for the environment. It never leaves the planet. So we're going to work on materials that biodegrade and working on composting and just reusing and making everything more renewable.
All right. Now, this global climate strike at the Capitol is in opposition, as I said, to Utah's oil and gas lease sales this year. Do you have any data on how much land is being leased to Utah oil and gas explorations?
I do. Mm-hmm. I wrote it all down yesterday. And I think somewhere I read yesterday that the Trump administration, I think this is around the U.S., I couldn't find in Utah, it's over 200,000. I think it's 244,000, which I read
acres,
yesterday.
Acres, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, for many people in Utah, the oil and gas industry is their livelihood. I mean, do you guys have any ideas? I mean, how do we help these families that who depend on the oil and gas industry, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Our goal isn't to, like, take people out of jobs ever. So it's just, like, about educating and helping these folks find new careers in renewable energy, and because people will still need to work within our energy. And so it's just making that transfer from unsustainable to renewable. And so it's also about, like, connecting with these employers and employees and just finding a way to educate and to help find a path to help everyone and not just, like, leave some people out of this movement, but really help benefit everyone.
All right. So this is happening on a Friday. There's also kind of this Fridays for Future. I guess it happens every Friday. Can somebody tell me about that?
So we strike at the Capitol every Friday. It was started by Greta Thunberg because she didn't like that the Swedish parliament wasn't taking action. So she decided to strike for 3 weeks, every day for 3 weeks. And then after those 3 weeks, she decided to do it every Friday. And then that, it took off on social media, and now like hundreds of millions of students do it.
Mm-hmm. So you guys are down at State Capitol every week?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. If you're looking for us, you'll find us there.
We love it. We learn so much, too, because there's all sorts of folks from different organizations that come together, old and young. There's, like, two-year-olds there, 50-year-olds, and it's just, like, a really great environment.
Mm-hmm. So what can people do to get involved and support your effort?
Well, obviously, they can come strike with us. That would be amazing. Or if they just support the movement and just talk about it and, like, let people know about what's happening in the oil and gas industry and that Utah government needs to take action. Yeah.
Yeah. You think you're making any impacts?
I really hope so. We've gotten
gotten a lot of really good feedback.
Yeah. We've gotten representatives to just, like they've started to really think about it, and,
they'll come out and talk to us, too, sometimes when we're striking about different issues that happened 2 weeks ago.
All right. And is there, like, a carpool location? Because, again, I mean, that's, right, that would be part of all of this.
Yeah. So we carpool, because we're the only three people in Park City that go up, but obviously when we meet more people, it's going to get easier to carpool and more.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want people to know?
Come to the strike on Friday.
Yeah. Educate yourself and educate the people around you.
It'll be videotaped as well, so you can find it online. Yeah, just show support.
Okay. So it's going to be on the south steps of the Utah State Capitol tomorrow, 2 to 4 p.m.
Yes.
Girls,
yes.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you
so much for having us.